The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Mike DeBaradinas. I'm a deputy mayor, and I'm the commissioner of the Department of Parks and Recreation. And I'm here tonight subbing for our mayor. If anybody saw the front page of the Inky today, the mayor is in Rome trying to convince the Pope to come here in about a year and a half. Right. I really want to go on that trip. I mean, my wife Joan encouraged me to beg, but I just couldn't, but I did suggest that I could be helpful with restaurants, museums, and a bad translation if he needed somebody to go along with him. But there was one good thing that came out of the non-invitation I got from the mayor for the trip to Rome, and that is an invitation to be here tonight with all of you. And I'm very happy to be here with Jane, of all the folks from Mural Arts, and here at the library, which is under my deputate. So I have a number of very good and fun reasons to be here. I'm honored to be here tonight as well, because this is the 20th anniversary of the library's author series. And I don't know how many of you are regulars to the series, but there's an incredible list of the most accomplished authors here on almost, a couple, maybe two nights a week. And out of that comes a wonderful civic and intellectual dialogue. And Joan and I were here just a couple of weeks ago for the burglary and the review of the people who broke into the FBI office and the author of the book. And that was a fantastic night for us. And we were here with lots of old friends. So we participate in that. And also, and most importantly, to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Mural Arts Program. Yeah. Tonight, my friend and executive director of the Mural Arts Program, Jaden Golden, will speak about her program and discuss with this audience the evolutionary history, the values, and the ideas contained in Mural Arts' third publication titled Mural Arts at 30. Not AT, but the at as on our computers. Working with Jane is a bit of a family project for Joan and I. During the 90s, when I ran the recreation department, Mural Arts was part of the department, and now Joan is the COO of Mural Arts. We both are moved and attracted to the idea that art and art making can be a community building venture, that public art can be anywhere, and that the process of creation of art is just as important as the product, and that our city and its neighborhoods, our history, our struggles, our hopes, and our aspirations can be imagined by us, the citizens, as well as created by us. And I think Jeremy Nowak in Mural Arts at 30, he does a section titled Murals and the Social Contract, and he talks about the program inspiring renewal and self-discovery. And I think Jeremy really hit it on the head in that section of the book. Mural Arts at 30 records and traces the growth and the evolving sophistication of the program. When Jane and I worked together at the rec department in the 90s, we talked a lot about expanding the impact of the program and about sticking around in the neighborhoods where the program was active, both during and after the mural making process. And over the decades, the program has taken these ideas seriously and has positioned itself as a trusted, talented, and capable partner with city departments, with nonprofits, with businesses, and with community organizations, working with them around their mission and a shared vision for the city and their communities. Mural Arts has grown as a remarkably good collaborator, and it has aligned itself with some of the most important issues that our city face, and also with those solutions and possible solutions. And that's in public education and community development, public safety, sustainability, reentry, and youth development, just to name some of those issues. Their scale and impact of these programs has been impressive. And let me just run through a few of these accomplishments. An 85,000 square foot mural at Philadelphia International Airport titled How Philly Moves, working with youth in scores of after-school art education programs in almost every neighborhood of the city, involving youth in wrapping 22 recycling trucks with colorful patterns and images to promote the single-stream recycling, training incarcerated young men and women with real job skills and a chance for productive employment upon their release, using art to build community and raise consciousness around hunger, and initiating and inviting internationally known artists, Haas and Han, and one of them was at our house, I forget which one, for dinner during that time, to create Philly Painting, a work with community residents, businesses, and local organizations to transform a four-block section of Germantown Avenue's business corridor into a brilliantly colored and syncopated streetscape. To call Jane and Mural Arts scrappy and determined is to belabor the obvious. Jane and her organization's noble ambition and its important and exciting history are beautifully and artistically captured in Mural Arts at 30. Also with Jane tonight, and I think he's going to come up first, is the co-editor of Mural Arts at 30, David Updike, and I just had a chance to meet him in the reception. He's an accomplished writer and editor on art and is well known in Philadelphia's art community. He's an editor in the publishing department of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and he's worked with both Temple University and the NYU Press. And just in closing about Jane, those of us who know Jane know that she, in a recent article, was aptly called a juggernaut. And I agree, because we need juggernauts for change in this city. And I think that's probably the best, you know, that's sort of a good title, and I think you should use it to advance the work. So anyway, Jane, I'm happy to have this evening with you, and David, congratulations on your wonderful accomplishment, and I think I'm going to bring David up now, who will speak, and then he'll bring our juggernaut for change up after he's done. All right. Thank you.
As Michael said, I'm David Updike. I'm co-editor of the book that we're here to celebrate tonight, Philadelphia Mural Arts at 30. In a little while, Jane is going to walk you through some projects and some history and talk about the broader aims of the Mural Arts program. But first, I want to say a few words about this book and about some of the things that I learned about Mural Arts along the way. I think it's safe to say that over the last 30 years, Philadelphia has become a city of murals. As you crisscross the city, you find them in just about every neighborhood, often where you'd least expect to see them. They've become a part of our landscape and something that people here and elsewhere associate with our city. A lot of the credit for this, of course, goes to Jane, because it wouldn't have happened without her energy and without her vision. But it also wouldn't have been possible if the city itself had not embraced the idea that public art matters. And it matters not just because it improves our aesthetic environment, which of course it does, but more importantly because it has a lasting impact on the people who participate in the process. The Mural Arts offices are a buzzing hive of activity. In the hallways, you pass a steady stream of people coming and going to and from mural sites or classes or canvassing neighborhoods. And these are people who, to borrow an old phrase from Bill Clinton, look like Philadelphia. They're young and old. They're black, white, Asian, Hispanic. And they all carry themselves with a sense of purpose. In the gallery downstairs, you'll see exhibitions of art, some of it quite remarkable, made by everyone from elementary school students to inmates serving life sentences at Greaterford. And then there's the room upstairs with the very skylight under which Thomas Aikens painted the Gross Clinic. How cool is that? And I suspect that our city's greatest painter, if he were alive today, would approve of this populist endeavor that seeks to embrace the city that he loved in all of its aspects. I'm very fortunate, as Michael said, to work at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, one of our city's other great cultural institutions. And it occurred to me as I started working on this book that, in a way, the Art Museum and the Mural Arts Program have opposite but entirely complementary missions. At the Art Museum, we try to bring people in to experience great art, but the Mural Arts Program takes art out into the neighborhoods where people live and where people work. And what Mural Arts brings to these communities is not a particular product or a particular aesthetic, but rather it's a process of engagement and dialogue and co-creation that takes place over months and years and whose effects remain long after the paint on the walls has dried. So this book seeks, above all else, to document what takes place off the walls. And really, this gets to the heart and soul of what Mural Arts does. Yes, it's about transforming places, but mostly it's about transforming people. We wanted to look at that process and its effects through many different lenses, so we brought together a diverse group of authors from different disciplines, from social sciences, from public health, from art education, from restorative justice, and we got them to paint as broad a picture as possible of what a socially engaged art practice looks like and what it can do, especially when it works in tandem with other organizations to address big issues, issues like homelessness, youth violence, or urban blight. In the book, Jeremy Nowak aptly refers to what happens in the course of creating a mural as a kind of social contract that arises between all of the stakeholders involved in a project. Neighbors, business owners, community leaders, schools, artists. And the key word here is stakeholders, because there has to be something at stake. People feel a sense of investment and ownership in the murals. They take pride in them. They show them off to visitors. New stories and rituals grow up around them. People now ride the Market Frankfurt L in West Philadelphia just to see Steve Power's 50 love letters unfold. And inspired by those murals, couples have gotten engaged and even gotten married along that 20-block stretch of Market Street. Other stories around the murals are more painful, more challenging, but also rewarding in ways that aren't necessarily visible to someone looking only at the end result. A particularly poignant example is James Burns's Finding the Light Within, which took on the issue of youth suicide, not just with a very powerful and personal mural, but also with community meetings, writing workshops, collage workshops, and a participatory blog, all of which provided safe, supportive spaces in which survivors could share their stories. More than 800 people participated in those activities, and hopefully some of them found a measure of healing in the process. Excuse me. Elizabeth Thomas begins her essay with a provocative question: who makes culture? In other words, who decides what messages we see and hear and read? Whose stories count? Every day we're bombarded by images and messages that tell us what we should wear, eat, drink, watch, listen to. But how often do we see our own struggles and achievements reflected in our environment, our own stories projected into the public discourse? Socially engaged art practice has begun to address this problem of who gets represented and who does the representing in public culture. It's happening in different ways in different cities, but in Philadelphia, its most visible proponent is the Mural Arts Program. Much of the work that Mural Arts has done in recent years has sought to expand the definition of what a mural is and what it can do. And I'm sure that Jane is going to discuss some of the more prominent recent examples. So I'll just mention one. And since we're in a library, I'll use a very literary example. For the project called Peace is a Haiku Song, the poet Sonia Sanchez initiated what became, in essence, a citywide collaborative poem cycle. She began with a mental image that she had of haiku written by children hanging like cherry blossoms from trees. This evolved into an invitation to people of all ages to contribute poems in a series of workshops and through a website dedicated to the project. The poems didn't end up hanging from trees, but many of them did end up on posters around the city that were created by young people working with graphic designer Tony Smirsky. The experience of seeing your own words and your own images projected into the world is an empowering one, especially for young people. As Cynthia Weiss points out, kids participating in mural projects often gain very practical, very real-world skills, like photography or graphic design or audio recording, but they also gain a sense of agency that may be hard to come by elsewhere in their lives. And that type of experience can have a lasting impact on a person's life in ways that we're really only beginning to understand. This is the essence of what mural arts does. It's about creating situations in which people are drawn out of their everyday selves and both challenged and empowered to reach for something more. So while this book marks a milestone in the history of the mural arts program, our hope is that it also points the way forward for others who want to use the power of art to change things for the better. I'm going to turn things over to Jane in a moment here. Before I do, I would like to just say a few thank yous to people. At Mural Arts, I'm very grateful to Jane, first of all, who is such an inspiration to us all, and also to Thora Jacobson, who brought me on board for this project and whose hand is everywhere in this book. I'm grateful to Sherry Babbitt at the museum for her support over the years, to Tony Smirsky, who designed the book with the utmost patience and creativity, and I'd also like to thank my former colleagues at Temple University Press, especially our editor, Micah Kleit, as well as Anne-Marie Anderson, Gary Kramer, and Charles Ault. And last but not least, I'd like to thank all of you for braving the weather, such as it is, to come out tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, David. That was great. So hi, everyone. How are you? So my name's Jane Golden, and I'm like really thrilled to be here tonight. It's just a privilege to have this job, and I want to thank, I want to start out by thanking Temple Press so much, because they published the first two books, and they wanted to publish a third, and we couldn't figure it out. What kind of book should we do? And we thought we'd do another coffee table book, because we did them pretty well the first two times, but they really pushed me, pushed us, and challenged us, and said, we want something that has national significance, that people all over the world can read about and think, that could be me, that could be our city, we could be doing that. So my colleague, my esteemed colleague, Thora Jacobson, who I adore, through her brilliance, she came up with this idea of working with these great essayists and having them look at our work through their own particular lens. And then she brought in David Updike, and I'm so grateful, David, to have worked with you, and then Tony Smirsky. So it was this great combination. So can we have a round of applause for a fantastic team? And just so you know what it looks like, this is, I just have to use this adjective because it was used in an article the other day, and it's sort of funny. The lavish book. Here it is, everybody. It's lavish. It's actually a little lightweight, so it's funny. Anyway, we like it. One other thing. I have to talk about Mike DiBiardinas just for a minute because, like, I love this guy. You know that in your life, there are people who change it. We all have people like that. And when I met Michael DiBiardinas, I thought, oh my gosh, we should be working for him. So we went about the business of like working undercover and meeting him at coffee shops and trying to figure out how this could happen. And we talked to former mayor, Mayor Rendell. And like it was like an answer to our prayer when Ed Rendell said, Jane Golden, you will be working at the Department of Recreation under Commissioner DiBiardinas. We were like, yes, that's so great because he is a visionary. And he is just a continual source of inspiration. I just talked to him for like 5 minutes downstairs, and I want to tell you, I was just riveted. He, like, if I want good counsel, if I want, like, wisdom, if I want insight, if I want to hear, like, creativity, I will talk to Mike DeBerardinis. And we are so lucky in this city to have a public servant like him. Deputy Mayor Michael DeBerardinis, thank you. He's modest, but we love him. Okay, so now we go. Now the book. So we're going to talk tonight. We're going to talk about how our program went from like this small program living on a wing and a prayer. We were the anti-graffiti network to where we are today. It was a complicated, difficult journey. It would be disingenuous if I were to stand up here and say, oh, it's just easy. It just happened. No, it took will and tenacity and dedication and perseverance. And it took a village. I am up here talking. I'm the executive director, yes, but I want to tell you the staff, the artists, the community leaders, government, the private sector, all things conspire to make who we are today. So we have this saying, thank you, Ed Tedemer, art ignites change. And you know what? Here's the deal. Like, we really believe this. And I don't care what people say. It's a cliche, blah, blah, blah. We believe it. And we see it. We see it in the audiences that we reach. We see it in the issues we dare to tackle. We see it in the partnerships we develop to leverage change. And we see it in the impact that we can have on people. So when I'm depressed and I think things aren't working and things seem bleak, what I do is visit an art ed site, or I go to Greaterford Prison, or I happen to sit in on a community meeting, or I talk to one of my wonderful colleagues. And I realize that art can ignite change. And that's the privilege of this job. And so the work we do is transformative, like this, how to turn anything into something else. You might have seen it on North Broad Street. I happen to really like that one because it's all about transformation. So over the years, we've tried to develop a culture of valuing change. And I love Rick Lowe. He is one of my colleagues from around the country. He's in Houston. He runs a program called Project Row House. And I like what he says. He says that you see this culture of change in our ambition, in the complexity and scope of the projects. And it's easy to rest on success and past accomplishments. But he says the fittest leaders and best organizations are those that have the nerve to value adapting to changing needs and circumstances. That is not easy. It is not easy to course correct, to say, you know what? We're not doing that so well. In fact, we need to change that. We need to look at practices around the country and around the world, and we need to be sponges and curious and always learning, and we need to adapt, and we need to be responsive, and that's what we've tried to be over the years. And so I'm going to quickly take you through our past. So 1984, Philly has a huge graffiti crisis and a new leader, our former mayor, Wilson Good. I had the honor of speaking with him the other day. He's very proud of this new book. And it was an amazing time in Philadelphia, right? There was graffiti everywhere. In some ways, it was chaotic, but he was our first African-American mayor, and that meant something. And he cared deeply and passionately about communities and kids who had fallen through the cracks. And he came up with this idea, and he said, I'm going to form the Anti-Graffiti Network, and I'm going to work with kids who are writing on walls. And people said, what? Cities all over the country are just painting out graffiti. That's what you should do. And he said, no, I think I'm going to think out of the box. So let's applaud our elected officials who do that, who embrace innovation and creativity, who put it at the center of their administration, and who take risks. We all talk today, all over this country, about government money. He put $6 million on the table and said, we're going to reduce graffiti in the city of Philadelphia, period. And we're going to use government money, because then it wasn't such a bad word, right? Then it was like, ooh, government money. But I want to tell you something about government money. When it's used well, it can move mountains. Graffiti was a social epidemic in the city of Philadelphia. I'm not wearing my glasses. I don't know who's in this audience who lived in Philly then. But I want to tell you something. It was everywhere. And people said it would not go away. And it did. And so he developed this program. Kids took a pledge. They swore they'd never write on walls for the rest of their lives. No one really believed it, but it was a beginning. They did scrub time. They were sent to me. I didn't know what to do. I was new on the job. I made $12,500 a year. My title was field representative. I didn't have a desk. I had an old car, and I was just told to figure something out. All I had a box of art supplies. So, but what I had assets. And these were my assets. I had these community organizers who promised they'd take me around Philly and show me what was going on. They introduced me to community leaders. I had extraordinary young people who had talent and gifts and potential that had sadly gone unrecognized. And I realized that I had something in common with graffiti writers. We liked heights. We didn't mind working out in the bad weather. They were wall hunters, and they loved art. They loved Mark Rothko and William de Kooning and Andy Warhol. And I thought, oh, we can do something. So we started doing a mural on the Spring Garden Street Bridge, and it wasn't very good art. And we had bad paint and big brushes, and everything went wrong. But it was sort of exciting because this bridge had been decimated with graffiti, and people were stopping every 5 minutes and saying to the kids working on this bridge, oh, my God, this is amazing. And the kids were like, really? So for kids who had failure etched in their forehead, this was a reprieve for them. Suddenly, they were being acknowledged as someone whose life mattered. And that counted. And it was a beginning. And then we brought in Ken Twitchell from L.A. who did the Dr. J mural. There we are, removing graffiti. You can see me there on the Spring Garden Street Bridge. That's from the Philadelphia Inquirer. I was so excited. I was like, oh, my God, I'm in the newspaper. I called my parents. And there you can see the pledge, right? See, everybody looks miserable. They're all, like, crossing their fingers behind their backs going, I'm not going to stop writing on walls. But you got to begin somewhere, right? And it was exciting, very exciting. And there's Dr. J. And this was, like, huge for us because Kent Twitchell was, like, famous. And he was getting, like, $50,000 a mural, which to us was sort of unheard of. And we had a $2,000 grant from the Arts Council, and we called up Kent. We said, would you come to Philly and do a mural for $2,000? And he said, yes, if I could do Dr. J in a suit. So we're like, huh, so interesting, Dr. J in a suit. This is why artists are so great. They always think of things you wouldn't think about. So he came, and we tracked down Dr. J, and he posed, and he was great, came to the dedication. But why I love this mural is because this site was an eyesore, because there was trash 5 feet high, and the wall was covered with graffiti. And back in those days, people said to us a lot, those walls you're working on will get defaced, and the kids you're working with are going to end up in jail. It was so offensive and so cruel, and we hated to hear it. But you know what? That's okay. Let those naysayers talk to me, because every time someone does that, that just makes me more tenacious. It makes me want to push back and keep moving, because you know what? The kids didn't think that. The communities didn't think that. They believed in our work, and that's all I needed, right? So we just said, oh, all right, whatever. Sometimes, I can't tell you how many times I had this conversation. Like, in life, if you don't take risks, what then? You're immobilized. So we just worked. And we cleared up this lot, and we painted this mural, and 1989, it's never been defaced. This never went back to being a dumping ground. It makes my heart sing when I go by there. And then, so the pace of change between 92 and 96, we were busy. We started doing murals everywhere. So now we have a new mayor, Mayor Rendell, and he's thinking about economic development of downtown. And so we started to raise some private money because our budget was really little when they divided up anti-graffiti. It's like when you're little and you have a spy club and you're the president, David, and you're the vice president and I'm the secretary or the treasurer and we have like 10 cents. So I went to Mike DeBiardinas and I was like, oh, you're raising money to open up swimming pools. Could we do that? And Mike D said yes. So we formed a board, got our 501c3, and we were off and running. And we started to, I'm telling you, we just went full force. We said we're a pro-arts program now, no more anti-anything. It's now 1997. We're starting to stir the pot, bringing in new artists, different artists, hiring emerging and established artists, opening our doors to all kids, not just graffiti writers. And so it was an exciting time. And this mural happened. So this stopped people in their tracks. Because suddenly people said, oh, murals, that's the same quality of art you see in museums. I'm like, right, think about Diego Rivera. He's a muralist. Michelangelo, he's a muralist. Like, what's up with this high art, low art thing? Let's just talk about art in public spaces. That's what we want to do. I wasn't so clear about it then, right? But now I like, oh, I get it. So when this mural went up, it was so interesting because context is important in life and if you're a muralist. So the way Meg Seligman looked at the architecture, looked at the color, and thought about young people who attended school across the street juxtaposed with figurines that belonged to her grandmom was really fascinating. And so we started hiring a lot of different artists and working at doing really interesting things. So now we have a new mayor, Mayor Street gets elected. So we've made it through four mayors. That's pretty exciting, right? I know, it's great. So every time a new mayor comes in, it's like Groundhog Day. And it's like, oh, okay, so got to get to know the mayor, got to get to know the commissioners, got to get to know the deputy mayors. But in the meantime, all these years, I was talking to these really great people from Cincinnati today, and I said, you know what we do? It's like an analysis. It's almost like an art form working for city government. Like, I love it. I think it's great. I love being a public servant. I like love being responsible to taxpayers. I want to work really hard on behalf of everyone. But that's my philosophy. But I feel that you have to. So when a new mayor comes in, you meet, you know, you try to infiltrate, but you make allies over the years. And so in the streets department, L&I, all these other departments, we have friends that stay, but the people at the top move around. So you want them to think of your program as being important and relevant and impactful. So that's what we did. And Mayor Street was very concerned with communities, neighborhoods, and kids. And so we met his managing director, Estelle Richmond, and she really liked our program. And so she made us part of the Division of Social Services. Again, another really key moment. So I want to just pause on this because, again, people can make a huge difference in the life of a program. So we've got Michael DeBerardinas and now Estelle Richmond. Go into Estelle's office. She has a mural calendar up. I'm like, good sign. So she says, what's your budget? It was small. So she says, wow, that's a small budget. I'm like, great. She said, well, what would you do with more money? And you know, anyone asked me that question. I'm like, well, let me tell you the 50,000 things on my mind. Like, I don't pause. So she was like, okay, come back with a proposal. So we did. And she like doubled our budget. It was like amazing. It was totally amazing. More importantly, she made us part of the social service division. And we were at the table with big commissioners who were visionary thinkers and had big budgets. And it was like, oh my God, could we work with the Department of Human Services, Department of Public Health, Department of Prisons? And the answer was yes. And so we started working with kids who were truant and delinquent. And we started working in the prison and working with the school district. And then we started offering classes at Greaterford Prison. But what was wonderful about this is that we were able to tap into our roots, right? We believe in mining the social power of art. We worked with kids who had failure etched in their forehead. We worked in neighborhoods where the only other visible city workers were the police. And we were undaunted. And so to have a mayor say, can you do this more? Can you serve more kids? Can you work deeper and better and richer in communities? The answer was yes. And to have these extraordinary colleagues in major departments around the city support our efforts was absolutely a dream come true. And you know what? Art should be part of the way government operates. Art does not have to be over there. Art should be part of our lives in a deep way. My colleague Jamie Bischoff said once, art is like the oxygen we breathe. It is the air we breathe. And if we believe it, then let's make it so by making it part of the culture of how we do business. And that's exactly what happened in 2003 and 2004 and 2005. And it was an extraordinary time. And when we started working in Greaterford Prison, we went there because an art therapist asked us to come in. And we were like, Greaterford Prison is far away. And we drove out there and we got lost and it was a lightning storm. I'm like, this is a disaster. We go in and there are 50 lifers in this lecture I give. And I'm like, how is anyone going to relate to this work? And then we started to get letters from people saying, Miss Golden, if only we'd had an anti-graffiti network or a mural arts program, we may not be sitting here tonight. We may not be sitting in prison. And we thought, wow, most of these men are from Philly. Is there something that we could do? And so we decided to offer some classes out there. And this project came about because we started doing murals inside the prison. And what really was the glue for us is when the men said, our lives went dark at age 10. And it made us think about the kids in our after-school program. So we took out the whole art ed staff then to Greaterford. And we said to the men, we want to do better. What should we do to make sure kids don't end up here? And they said, give us a few weeks. And they wrote up like what was the equivalent of like a PhD thesis. And they said, this is exactly what you all should be doing. And we took some of that very seriously and integrated those ideas into our curriculum. But also we realized that the men are not there in a vacuum, that they have kids and grandkids and they're connected to communities. And it's not exactly the nameless, faceless people we want to conjure up that we think are in prisons. And so what are we going to do about it? Our response was, let's work. Let's move forward. Let's deliver services because that's what we should do. And we love this Bernard Hopkins mural because he learned to box in prison. And when we dedicated this, he came there. He came there. When I turned around, he was crying. And he said, I am so moved by this. I'm just so moved. He said, and he spoke about resilience and the power of that. And we feel that in the men who are out there and in people across the city. And the value of collaboration. This is something that is so important. And here, both Thora and David talk about this, I think, really eloquently. The most successful practitioners are those who learn to begin with questions rather than answers, to listen rather than instruct, and to remain open, knowing that in the end, the value of the work lies not only in the image it portrays, but in the conversation it creates. This is what social practice is, right? That's what people talk about around the country now. Curators, academics, and activists talk about this kind of work that values process. And for us, process is collaboration. It's not easy. It's difficult. It's complicated. But it is hugely rewarding. And the fact is that you start with questions is something actually that we've always done. In the late 80s, we said to people, what do you want here? We didn't know the answer to that. And we have been asking questions ever since. Because I think what my dad taught me when I was young is true, that you have to enter into any kind of situation with a degree of humility. And that's what we try to embody at Mural Arts. And when you talk about collaboration, let me talk about a couple of our really difficult collaborations, like Healing Walls. One of the more rewarding projects we've worked on, but difficult. We brought in together crime victims and prisoners and victims' advocates. Victims' advocates, some of whom felt they should not be doing art in prison, but they had the courage to participate. This was the kind of collaboration that people in the beginning said won't work, but Barb Taves, a restorative justice specialist, the Prison Society, again, collaboration, partners, bringing people in, knowing that we don't have all the answers. But what we want to do is ask people, what would Philadelphia look like if it were safer? What about the impact and consequences of violent crime in the city? What is it doing? How is it eating away at the heart and soul of the city? And you know what? People responded. They responded with courage and directness, a fierceness, an honesty, and an eloquence. And the conversations that took place were startling and painful. And there were moments when I felt like totally over my head. And then something would happen that would unite people. So that's the beauty of this work, right? There's something about this work that lifts up commonality, but it celebrates our diversity. It underscores the fact that we're different. That's okay. But we can connect. My husband, Tony Hariza, who is wonderful and a source of inspiration, always remarks on that collaboration, that collaborative aspect of our work, that it's something unusual that's happening. So in Healing Walls, when everybody who was arguing painted together, they started listening and hearing each other and seeing each other as humans. The commonality set in then when people picked up a brush. And Howard Zaire he's like the godfather of restorative justice in this country. And I love what he says. Conflict and harm often emerge from toxic fusions of history and violence and power and imbalance and bad communication. Artistic approaches hold the potential to engage multiple interpretations, ambiguity, juxtaposition, and paradox in addressing a given conflict. Healing Walls, there were two walls. It was supposed to be one, but it was different journeys. But out of recognizing and respecting the different journeys came a sense of respect for each other. It's the other side. So in 2007, we started working with the Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services. This was another life-changing moment. So Dr. Arthur Evans, our mental health commissioner, is a visionary. And he often talks about the black box way of working. He said, we can send bureaucrats into neighborhoods and they can knock on doors and say, hi, I'm here from the city, I'm here to help you. And people will say, no thanks, I've received no services or bad services. And so he took a chance with us. He believed in us. And he supported a project in Southwest Philadelphia. And this is called Bridging the Gap. And at this point, there was a lot of conflict between West Africans and African Americans. And there had been some violence, pretty serious violence. And when we went there, I mean, at first, no one really wants to talk. And certainly nobody really wants art in the beginning. Let me just put that on the table. That it happens over time. It happens by asking questions. It happens by talking to people and engaging people in a conversation in the most respectful way possible. And so we would have these gatherings and have food, and eventually people would start to talk and eat together and then talk together and then design together and then seek help together to get services. And Dr. Evans was like, I can't believe this is happening. It was remarkable. Several months after this mural was finished, together these groups hosted a forum on economic development. Some of the changes happen when we're there, and some of the changes happen when we're long gone. And that important catalytic ripple effect of our work is exciting and inspiring. And we saw it there in that neighborhood. And that planted the seeds for an extraordinary partnership with the Department of Behavioral Health. I love this project. We did this when there was a spike in juvenile violence. And in 2006, it's by Don Gensler. And these are eyes of people who witness violence. And there's an artist who I really respect her work, Peggy Diggs. She came down from Connecticut and she said, you know, this is intimacy in a public space. And I love that because that's what I feel. This project is on 400 squares of parachute cloth and involved thousands of people around the city, from teachers to people from the DA's office to mom who've lost kids to violence to kids who've been in and out of institutions. Everyone worked on this. The Inquirer followed it, wrote about it. Kids wrote a book. They did incredible, extraordinary poetry about this. And there's a book by Maureen O'Connell who did her postdoc work on mural arts. And I love this quote. Murals proclaim, sometimes in a furtive whisper, barely audible over the din of the neighborhood, and at other moments in full-throated shouts that drowned out the static of the suburban culture that surrounds the city, that social change begins when human beings try to make sense of their lives and defiantly refuse to accept the idea that nothing new is possible. Defiantly refuse. I love that. That's what I have seen in people for 30 years. And building social capital. You heard David talk about this. You heard Michael talk about this. That is what we do. Jeremy Nowak framed it really well when he talked about it as this social contract. It's a process that builds social capital and creates opportunities, sometimes small, sometimes dramatic, for engagement that crosses boundaries between public, private, and civic sectors. It involves volunteers, but it's also well-organized. It's working on lots of different levels all the time. But it actualizes relationships, some of which have existed. They're there, but maybe not connecting, but most of which are new. 2009 to 2013, okay, so now we have a new mayor, Mayor Nutter. And here, an expanding landscape of practice. And yes, indeed, it did expand, because under Mayor Nutter, our work has quadrupled, because he is a mayor who embraces creativity and social change. And he has extraordinary deputy mayors and commissioners so that we could build more robust partnerships. And so new programs that have come about over the last number of years, the Porch Light program, where we use art to overcome the stigma of mental health issues. The Guild is our reentry program, a very good program, very rigorous program for people returning from prison. Restored Spaces, which is all about art and the environment and equity and justice and making the community connected to the schools and turning schools that look like prisons into beautiful places. And we expanded our art education division. And we now focus on project-based learning, on serious sequential instruction, and mentorship with practicing artists. Our special projects division has grown tremendously, and there are new opportunities we've discovered to work with city departments in transportation and streets and commerce and park and rec. And building capacity. And I love this. I love what David and Thora said, that Mural Arts has been called upon repeatedly to reshape, refocus, and reimagine its mission without losing sight of the core principles that animate its practice. That's right. We have changed. People said, you know, many years ago, someone said, is this mission drift? It's not mission drift. This is us believing in the social power of art. And restorative justice. Our restorative justice program makes my heart sing. We're working in prisons. We have our reentry program. We're at the Youth Study Center and St. Gabriel's Hall. This is the impact. This project was about the impact of prison on families, mailboxes where people could leave comments about what they think that over 2 million people are incarcerated in this country. This wall by Eric Oakday has QR codes so you could hear the voices. We brought together people who provide services for people who have families in prisons with people who have been in prison. This is a Guild project. So when I say the Guild, it's our reentry program. Our reentry program has a recidivism rate of 9%. You know what the national average is? 66. Yay. See, our programs. So this is a community garden. This is by Yuri Jones. This is by Ben Valto. I'm saying who the lead artist is, but the Guild worked on this. Beautiful. Old City. We broke the glass ceiling. The first mural in Old City. I was so excited. And they were too. And the Porch Light Program. DBH. I know Sam, Samantha Matlin's here tonight. And Sam, we love working with you. And so Personal Renaissance. All these projects here are all different, all unusual. Some work with women who have been homeless. Some with people in going through addiction. And some between with returning vets from Iraq and Afghanistan. David referenced the project we did with people who had lost a loved one to suicide. And then we were working with the Nepali, the Bhutanese, and Burmese community. This is the project we did at Jev's on a methadone clinic. And I love this because people said to me, I no longer feel like an addict. I feel like an artist. And that has power. Ernell Martinez and Keir Johnston. This is the one we did with returning vets. I have to go fast because we're running out of time. This is about the, this one is so beautiful. And I, you know, when we drove up for the dedication, this is by James Burns, the people were touching the wall. And out of this, a community formed. No one wanted to talk about suicide. Who wants to talk about it? It's in the shadows. But see, Dr. Evans' hunch was right. Make people feel safe. Bring people together and connect them. Let them feel heard and respected. And here's the one we're doing with the Nepali, Bhutanese, and Burmese community. And what's great is we're taking over hubs around the city and we're implanting ourselves in empty spaces, turning empty spaces into lively community centers and offering everything from Nepali dance to cooking to sewing to printmaking to mural making. And then more projects started going. And I'll just, this is just a list. You can see restored spaces, special projects, How Philly Moves. That's the airport in Philly painting and Art Ed, all kinds of great things. Here's restored spaces about global climate change. And we built this outdoor interactive learning structure that won a prize in the Venice Biennale. Who knew, right? That was so exciting. And then we're doing a new project up in West Philadelphia, working with We the Weeds, a whole new, an artist collective and botanists. And so our work is growing and growing in all different directions. And How Philly Moves. Look at this. We had, this is 85,000 square feet. This was not for the faint of heart, right? This was incredible, extraordinary, big, a math puzzle. And a professional artist was at the top of the food chain, J.J. Tizou, and John Leidecker. But the team was made up of people from art education, behavioral health, our reentry program. It was a team of people that represented the city of Philadelphia. We could shift the definition of how public art is made. It does not have to be made by a lone practitioner, as good as that is. It's not a judgment. But we need to broaden our definitions. And when we do that, our lives are infinitely enriched. And Philly Painting, a big, bold, difficult project. A project that you just go, oh my God, is another problem going to happen today? And the answer is yes. Our COO, Joan Riley, is an extraordinary person. Extraordinary. I adore her, and I every day I work with her, I am so thankful. But I'm sure this has tested the patience of an extremely patient person, because everything that could go wrong with projects like this goes wrong. But what's the option? Do you not go forward? You try to do it with intelligence and insight and make good decisions and be safe, but you want people's lives to change, to be enriched, to be lifted up, to be impacted by color. 61 buildings down here were wrapped in color. The Commerce Department said they were stumped by this. But working with them strategically as a partner, as a collaborator, we were able to make some things happen. It is not perfect. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. I'm not going to stand up here and sugarcoat everything. But I want to tell you something. The option of not doing anything is just unacceptable. Because people deserve better. And our recycling trucks, yay, we wrapped a fleet of recycling trucks. Kids, what did they study? Single stream recycling, industry of the turn of the century, looked at patterns of fabric, things that were made in Philadelphia in the 1900s. And then they also worked the second time around with the drivers. It was a great project. It was so exciting. We had a big parade. And then Peace is a Haiku Song. David talked about that, which was really wonderful. I mean, I think that this practice of writing haiku, the strong friendship between the project leaders, I have to say this project nourished everyone's soul. So Sonia Sanchez is talking to kids in our Art Ed program. Kids in our Art Ed program are writing. We're having citywide haiku workshops. There are mini murals. If you follow the little murals, you see, there it is. You see the big mural, which is so beautiful. And on this mural, we have quotes by Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, Alice Walker. And you can see the mini murals. And then A Place to Call Home was about the impact of homelessness on our kids. We think of homelessness, we often think of adults, but 60% of our kids face housing insecurity, as do many kids throughout the city of Philadelphia. And so we worked with Shira Walensky, Ernell Martinez, Elizabeth Perez Luna, who did an extraordinary audio mural. We painted an entire block. Look at that. We brought in services. We cleaned lots. We brought in extra police presence. We cleaned graffiti. We provided services. We took over a house and turned it into an art house. And it was also art as advocacy and activism, because we raised the bar on, listen, everybody, this is a critical issue. Let's think about it. Let's do something about it. Practicing in public. I love this quote. I think that Liz Thomas has been really interesting to work with. We have a visiting curators program, and seeing our work through the eyes of curators has been absolutely invaluable. So she says, mural arts has evolved, as most artists, collectives, and nonprofits do. Its motivations directed by the perception of needs, the identification of opportunities, and the articulation of desires both within the organization and throughout the city it serves. Like Project Row Houses, it has come to understand art's role in multifaceted, large-scale initiatives, how an artistic process shapes conceptual thinking about place, and how a public art organization can reflect and generate community. The optimum word there is generate community, those two words. Generative, right? Our practice should always be that. And capacity reconsidered. So what does it mean? You know, you need a scaffolding, you need a strong foundation, you need training, you need professional development, you need staff that are committed. And so we've had to think continually, be on our feet to think, okay, if we're ambitious, it's not enough just to live on a wing and a prayer. We need this organization to be strong, to sing, and to think about sustainability. So Art Ed, Porchley, Restorative Justice, firmly, we're like, and hub-based work, we're trying to raise money to embed these things into our practice and to provide stewardship for a growing collection of murals. Preservation is critical. We're not just willy-nilly creating murals around the city that will just somehow, like, you know, be okay or not okay. This is a collection. You heard from David. He works at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. We take our collection as seriously as they do. And so we have an advisory group led by a conservator who had been at the Getty Museum. This is very serious. Some murals will go away and be decommissioned. Others will be refurnished, like the Keith Haring mural. And some will get tinkered with. But we are highly aware of the need for preservation. And then developing new projects. We want to be proactive. We want to be sponges. We want to figure out what's going on around the country and the world that's interesting, innovative, and life-changing. And the evolving practice, new ways to talk about our work. It's ephemeral, contextual, challenging, and performative. I love that, performative. Co-created, risk-taking, innovative. Here's an example. Or Does It Explode? We worked with Dred Scott to do light boxes. Journey South, about the waves of immigration. Along Passyunk Avenue, we worked with a multidisciplinary team of artists. The Meal, 70 by 70, Act 34, where we worked with Lucy and Jorge Orta to do an extraordinary meal across from City Hall with 1,000 people. Rise and Shine, beautiful, inspiring, a beacon made by hundreds of people in recovery. What's coming up? Lots of things. I'll just highlight this. Psyche Lustro by the very well-known artist Caterina Grossa. We're going to be working along the Amtrak corridor. It'll be poetic, episodic. It'll be bursts of color, color that comes towards the viewer. It'll be extraordinary, unlike anything you've ever seen, in an area where nothing has been done for a zillion years. It is really difficult and really challenging. And as Philadelphians, I hope that you're extremely proud of it. There'll be a wonderful audio component as well, as if you're in a museum. And there is the track, The Art Will Follow. And I can't show you slides of it because it's a secret and you're all going to be surprised. But in the end, I just want to say that there's a saying that I love. Some of you have heard it. And that is that hope is believing in spite of the evidence and watching the evidence change. This presentation I showed you, the work we're doing now, the work we've done over 30 years, it's about believing in things before they're real, and it's about watching that evidence change. And I want to say to all of you, it is an honor and a privilege to do this work, and I am deeply grateful to be part of an organization that believes that art can ignite change. Thank you. I also want to thank, could the staff at Mural Arts please stand up, because, and could everyone, I don't be shy, please, because they're extraordinary. They're really extraordinary.
Hello, everyone. How about another round of our applause for Jane and David? So we have a few minutes for questions. If you raise your hand, we will get a mic to you. Who would like to start us off? Yeah, gentleman in blue about eight rows back.
What's the secret to getting the, like the, you talked about professionalism and the volunteers, and it must have been incredibly tough sometimes. As much as you love the kids who did the graffiti, back in the 80s especially, and even now, you love the kids, you want them part of it, you love the prisoners, you want them to help you make art, but, you know, you make incredibly beautiful murals, right? I mean, the professionalism of some of those murals with the shading, and I mean, amazing. So how do you get that
well,
to happen?
I'm actually glad you asked that question, because I want to be really clear to everybody who's here, and you can spread the word, that our work is created by professional artists. It's not like the community. The community is engaged in the visioning. And we have paint days. But those days are done with a lot of care. So everything is really blocked out. Like, at the top of the food chain are the professionals, and then if it's Art Ed or Porch Light Program or the Reentry Program, like, there is a real methodology at work. There is a curriculum. People are studying. It's done really carefully and with a lot of rigor. In order to do any kind of work at Public Art at Mural Arts, we have a very thorough, rigorous design review process. Nobody is just jumping on the wall and doing work, right? There's steps, as if you were doing a sculpture. So all those kids that we work with, and this is why parachute cloth has changed our lives, because people are working indoors, in studios, at sites, on squares of cloth, or if they're doing mosaic and ceramic, again, in a studio under a controlled environment. How Philly Moves was giant, and a lot of people worked on it. But you look at that, it's beautiful, right? And because there were lead artists at the top of the food chain controlling what happened. Now, there are, in our Art Ed program, there are youth-led murals. So they're a little different, right? They're smaller, but great for kids to be civic leaders. In reentry, they have some autonomy, but there is a lot of controls because, in the end, we're doing public art, and we are responsible to the citizens of the city, and it has to be good. Oh, no. No, no, no. Because people can participate. It's very participatory, but it's controlled. And the thing is, if there's someone who says, look, I want to do a mural, like, I want to go and do this theme, and it doesn't fall into our artistic vision or our artistic plan for the year, they can go do it. Like, there's not a moratorium on who does murals in the city. So sometimes we'll just encourage people, okay, you should go do that. That would be good, and we'll give you some technical advice. But it may not fall within our purview. So we can balance it that way too.
Another question.
Yeah, I know a lot of the other communities or neighboring countries around the world, cities and so on, have come and looked at the Mural Arts program to see what we've been doing. And are there cities that have done an exceptional job with their mural programs after visiting Philadelphia?
Where's Cincinnati? Where's everybody from Cincinnati? Did they leave? Oh, there was a whole delegation here earlier. They're doing a great job. I was very impressed. And then they're not the only ones. There are like a lot of cities. They're like 100 cities, probably. And there's cities around the world. Like in Hanoi, they're doing a 3-mile-long all-ceramic mural about the 1,000-year history of Hanoi. When my husband and I went to Hanoi to see them 5 years ago, we were like, are they really going to hit 3 miles? But I think they're like at 4. So it's like going. And it's sort of, it was like, this was like their first non-monument work of public art in Vietnam. It was like fantastic. And so, yeah, it's really exciting. Paris, London, Dublin. This is, you know what? It's great for Philly. I mean, it's great for mural arts. It's great for Philly because it's like we're exporting this. And a lot of the artists we work with are now doing murals around the world. Some of the artists, we can't book them anymore because they're like off in Copenhagen and Prague and here and there. But that's like, we're so happy for them and proud.
Gentleman all the way in back there.
Yes, sir. I worked for CareerLink out in Delaware County before I retired. And I worked in prisons and so forth and so on. Are any of the prisoners being used for the work? Because obviously, when a person gets out of prison, they can't work with children, they can't work with seniors, they can't work with money because of the laws that have been established by our government. Are any of the prisoners being used in these art projects at all?
Yeah, they do projects. They do serious projects. Some of the projects I showed tonight actually were painted by people in our reentry program. And they're providing, they're also doing good deeds. They're cleaning up lots. Some sites in the city that are just eyesores, they're cleaning up and turning into like beacons, like works of art. I mean, small community centers that are bereft and just, I mean, with graffiti and they're just, the community doesn't know what to do and there's no money to fix them up. But these guys who are learning these skills can mobilize and get out there. And as they're being changed, they're changing the environment. That's the beauty of this. It's a total win-win. So yes, they are. They're working. They're learning building skills, landscaping, and mural making. And then they put it to work. And it's quite extraordinary to see. And they feel really changed. When I see them, I'm like, oh, how you doing? They're like, oh, this is like the best day of my life. Like, what could be bad? I'm working for the mural arts program. And you know what? If our budget somehow miraculously tripled in that area, like, we would put more people to work. And guess what? Then more people would be staying away from prison because they feel good about their lives because their life counts and people are reinforcing it and they're learning skills. I'm not saying this work is easy, right? We have a part-time jobs developer on staff. It's difficult. But when the program, you structure it with lots of rigor and lots of love, it's a really good combination.
I'm really proud of you. I'm proud of the program. I'm lifelong Philadelphian, grew up in West Oak Lane. I've seen the rise and fall of the city and now the rise. This is a great, wonderful thing. But I have a question for you and a question for Mike. I do a lot of cycling. I senior citizen, I go down to the Schuylkill and I go around East Falls Bridge and I love every minute of it. But I have noticed recently that there is a... you'd have to call a defacement of a lot of bridges and historic structures. And if you go over to the skateboard park and you look across the river, there's been a lot of graffiti done over there too. And it's, I guess, individual.
Sir, do you have a specific question you want to ask?
Yeah,
because
we're
out of time.
Yeah, how do you feel about it? And what can be done about it? And where do we go from here?
Well, I'll say, I think graffiti goes in cycles. That's my observation over the years. I mean, it's not, somebody recently was in New York and in LA I talked to, and graffiti is, it's like so much worse, but I see it. And so, I think that the best for me, I know graffiti writers, if the longer their tags stay, it's not good, so you've got to try to get it off fast. And I think we're very interested in mural arts because of this train line project we're doing. And we've made some overtures to some of the, I would say, graffiti artists. I don't know that they're writers. But we're thinking, what can we do to re-engage that population of young people and try to reroute them like we did back in the day? And it's a really good question you're asking, and it's something that is very much on our mind. And I have a feeling that we're going to move on that in some creative way soon. And it'll probably involve Mike DeBerardinas, but he doesn't know it yet.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have to end the night. Please join me in thanking David Updike and Jane.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.